Dave Ross with Aaron Granillo, who's filling in for Colleen this morning. Aaron spoke with CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger about this new report on American sentiment concerning the economy, how people feel about it.
Yeah, and I think this is important because what we've seen over the last 10 years is that the economy has slowly and steadily added jobs almost every single year. In fact, the consistency of job growth over, you know, two Obama administrations and one the first 3 years of a Trump administration has been wildly consistent. And what we now know is the consistency of that job growth plus a little bit of wage gains has translated in people feeling more comfortable with their own financial situation. So the Gallup organization released a poll, and they do this all the time. They say, are you better off financially than you were a year ago? 59% of Americans say, yeah, I am better off than I was a year ago. And that's a big jump up from 50% the prior year. More importantly, this is the best result since January of 1999. So it is really a big jump. And it does tell me that people are feeling much better about their prospects because of the job market. I really think this has very little to do with the stock market. In fact, we can kind of go back in time and see just how the stock market can help people who have money. But for the vast majority of Americans, the fact that you have a job that can help pay your bills, that's the most important factor in your financial security.
Is this because of policies instituted by President Trump? We know the president takes credit for the strong stock markets. Are people feeling better about the economy because of what the president has done since he took office?
I don't think so. I think this is really about the consistency of the labor market and the ability for employees to actually get better wages. And we did see something really interesting happen. Now, wage growth hasn't been that good. All right. It just hasn't. Over the last decade, you know, that was the sort of the thorny part of the like the job market. We'd create jobs, but wages weren't rising that quickly. Now, all of a sudden, wages have started to rise in, say, the last 3-4 years. And most importantly, at the low end of income earners. And this has really most to do with local municipalities like Seattle raising minimum wages. And when you have a big group of municipalities or states raising wages, it forces large companies like the Walmarts or the Amazons to pay higher wages across their entire workforces. So what we now know is that even though there's been no change to the federal minimum wage, the effective minimum wage in this country right now stands at $12 an hour. And that's a big change from where we were 10 years ago.
Okay, you talked about rising wages for low-income workers. We know high-end workers are also making money, but there's also the middle class. I mean, is the middle class seeing some relief as well?
Well, I think that that's really the big issue. That's the elephant in the room, which is if the high end is doing well and the low end's doing well, how's the middle doing? The middle is doing better, meaning that wages are rising. However, the middle still cannot claim to be better off than it was 20 or 30 years ago. Mm. Essentially, the middle is the one part of the income strata that's stuck at where it was in, say, you know, the year 2000 or even in the year 1995 when you adjust for inflation. That's the hard part because, you know, I'm sure that there are people listening to this and saying, okay, thanks a lot, Schlesinger. It sounds like things are great. Not for me. I get that. And I think that that's really the discontent you hear among the U.S. labor market. You know, we say 59% say I feel better, but that's a feeling, right? Mm-hmm. The actual gauge of how well people are doing shows that the middle has not had great progress in the last two decades.
So the 60% of Americans who say they are feeling better about the economy, do you feel like that includes a lot of people in the middle class?
Well, I have to assume it includes a bunch of people in the middle class. I can't say for sure. What I can say is that, you know, people's feelings shift in a very strange way. And when I really, you know, kind of dig deep into the difference between how people feel and reality, there's often a disconnect. So we have seen times. Let me give you an example. In the same survey, it says, how you feeling about next year? Mm-hmm. And people are like, oh, I'm feeling great about next year, right? Because they say, you know, what they'll think about is they'll say, hey, I feel better about the previous year. That will translate into the following year. Well, 74% say they will be better off financially a year from now. That's the highest since Gallup's trends started in 1977. And I bet you that if we went back in time, we could find periods in the economy where people said, I think I'll do better next year, and it has washed up. For example, how about 1999? For example, how about 2007? We tend to feel really good after something good has happened, but we have a very poor way of anticipating what the following year will bring us.
Okay, that leads me to my next question. How are you feeling about the next jobs report in light of the coronavirus outbreak? Because the January jobs report did not take into account the hit that the Chinese economy has taken. What are we expecting for next jobs reports?
You know, I don't think that there's going to be as many industries directly impacted. I think the big one is anything tourism related, mm-hmm. and especially in cities where they rely on Chinese tourism. And I'm not sure in the Seattle area, you know, what the real influx is. I know that anecdotally there's been reporting in L.A., the Bay Area, and New York, and in areas where they have relied upon Chinese tourists, and that they say that business has fallen off pretty dramatically. There's a couple of estimates out there, you know, anywhere ranging from $6 billion to $10 billion less in spending by Chinese tourists to the United States. So, I mean, I don't think that there's going to be a massive impact in our numbers, but there will be some impact, and the impact of the coronavirus is really going to take a while to play out. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. I have been watching the Chinese reports of which businesses are open or closed. I note today that many businesses were supposed to open, mm-hmm. but many of them did not. Most U.S. large multinationals have banned travel to China, have banned travel to Hong Kong, and are encouraging their employees to work from home.
CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Brought to you by Opus Bank. How afraid should we be about this novel coronavirus? I thought we'd talk to a doctor who himself has just gotten over about with influenza.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So what kind of flu did you have?
Yeah, I had flu A, and I got the flu shot. And the flu shot is supposed to protect against flu A and flu B. But unfortunately, this year, the flu vaccine is only about 70% effective for flu A. It's even less effective for flu B. So hospitals are seeing lots of patients with flu B and flu A as well.
Were you worried you might have had the coronavirus?
So first of all, coronaviruses have actually been around for a long time. They're just a type of virus, and they typically affect our respiratory tract. SARS was a type of coronavirus as well. So what is in the news right now is a new or novel coronavirus.
And right. That's what they're calling it, the novel coronavirus. So exactly. Well, this idea of viruses leaping from animals to humans, and apparently this happened in one of those wet markets in China. Now, is that how frequent is that? Because that's a little bit worrisome, especially if you're in the habit of buying a lot of fresh food.
That actually probably is how most viruses enter the human system. They probably start in animals and then somehow move from animals into humans. Now, initially it was thought that it came out of this fish market in Wuhan, China. But now they're starting to think, well, maybe it's actually been around for a lot longer. And maybe that wasn't the original site. So there's a lot of confusion about where it's actually started and where it came from.
So how did your own battle with the flu work out, with the flu A?
Well, it's interesting because I don't remember being sick in probably over 15 years. And I think some of that is because, well, I get vaccinated every year. And I've always felt because I worked in a children's hospital and during the winter months, there's, you know, the intensive care unit's always filled with kids with all kinds of respiratory illnesses. I felt like I was always getting some sort of low level exposure and probably developed a pretty good immune system as a result of that. And I was quite ill for, you know.
Well, you developed pneumonia.
I did. I got a secondary pneumonia, which is one of the risks. And then I had to, you know, take antibiotics. I mean, after, a week of being off of work and quarantining myself, I feel much better. But, you know, that's the problem is you have to make a conscious decision to stay away from other people.
Right. And that's why I'm doing this interview over Skype. So,
right.
Yeah. Just for my own protection.
You're welcome. I think one of the other things that has come up a lot is traveling on airplanes. The myth is that it's the recycled air. But the fact is the air actually goes through a HEPA filter that filters out, 99.9% of the viral particles. So the reason you really get sick on a plane is because you're in close contact with other people who are nearby you and you're around their germs for, many hours at a time. Or because these viruses can live on surfaces, they can still be on the armrest or on the seatbelt or on the tray in front of you. So you'll often see now people more and more when they get on the airplane taking, Clorox wipes and wiping down their seat and wiping down their seat belts and everything. And, you sort of think, gosh, that's a, pretty neurotic, obsessive person. But actually, it's a pretty smart thing to do, especially this time of year, because it's actually one of the few ways that you can protect yourself from getting the illness. So there actually is a real risk with flying, which is that the air is dry at high elevation. And there's low levels of humidity. And actually, viruses thrive in low humidity environments. And when there's low humidity, our mucous membranes tend to dry out. And so the mucus that we normally produce to protect ourselves, it's not there to adequately protect us. So, those things really do actually add to the risk of getting an infection when you fly.
So if the person in the seat next to you starts wiping down the armrest, it's nothing personal. And actually, you should probably thank them for it.
Yeah, that you probably should. And actually, I should mention, there was a study, it's interesting, over 10 years ago that showed the risk of who gets sick when somebody is sick on an airplane. If you're in the aisle seat, people to your right or to your left, depending on which aisle you're in, I guess, those two people will get sick. And then the aisle across from you is at risk. And then, the people in the row behind you and the row in front of you, those are the people who are at risk that are all within two seats. So it was interesting in this particular study because they showed that people who sat by the window seat were at lower risk of getting sick, whereas those who sat at the aisle seat were at the highest risk of getting sick.
Take a window seat, take the disinfecting wipes, and wear a mask. All right, I'm glad you're feeling better, Dr. Cohen.
Yeah, thank you. And I don't have the novel coronavirus, so.
Yes. Well, maybe next time we'll do this in person instead of Skype. But
that's right.
I feel safer this way for now.
Yeah, you should.
Stay well.
Yeah, thanks. You take care.
So I didn't realize that, but that's what the studies show, that you can be essentially infected by someone two seats away on the airplane if they have this kind of virus. I still haven't. Well, I haven't flown in a few months, but I haven't seen anybody wipe down the seats yet or wear a mask. And personally, if I was flying, I don't know if I want to walk on the plane with a mask. Because it wouldn't look like I was trying to protect myself. It would look like I was the sick one.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the vibe I always get is, oh, geez, that person must be sick, as opposed to they're trying to stay healthy from everybody else.
I don't know. 5 hours knowing that you were within two seats of somebody who had something that is really communicable like this.
Yeah, what you could do.
But apparently it's not any worse than the flu.
Exactly. Yeah, so. That's the thing. Just because we don't have a lot of really good information, it seems like, coming out of China, and everyone's like, oh, they get really fired up about it. But yeah, the regular flu is probably worse.
It is. That's comforting.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, Chris.
Yeah, well,
Sure, you've heard about this idea. There is legislation in Olympia that would eventually ban cars that use gasoline, which sounds crazy, but maybe not, according to one state lawmaker who has that proposal on his to-do list. And here's Car Radio's Hannah Scott.
Her to-do list.
Her
this
to-do
is a proposal
list.
From Seattle
Democratic
Representative Nicole Macri behind the bill.
Mandate that beginning in the year 2030, all new production cars in Washington state being registered would need to be 100% zero emission or electric vehicles.
She knows how it sounds.
When I first heard about this bill idea, it seemed crazy to me. It just seems so ambitious. But as I worked on it really over the last year and a half, I came to be a true believer in that this is the kind of approach that we need to take.
And here's why.
The United States is lagging behind many nations in the world who are taking similar action. In fact, the United Kingdom just this week nationwide enacted a similar legislation to move to 100% clean vehicles, new production vehicles in 2035. And we all, I think, in the last couple of years have come to understand that we need to move a lot more quickly in moving to clean energy options than we previously thought. This is a way to really underscore the point around that.
And she says the good thing about her bill is it's not just the mandate.
I've taken not to predict.
It also lays out this very big plan on at a long runway, she calls it, over the next 10 years for the Washington Transportation Commission to make all these rules and make sure that we have enough charging stations and move away from the gas tax so that we have another way to fund our transportation needs and all of that. And as far as when we started talking about this in the newsroom last week, I got a lot of questions just here locally about the constitutionality of telling people, you know, what they can buy, what they can't buy, what they have to buy. She says this proposal doesn't work like that.
No, it would require that the Department of Licensing could only register and license new production vehicles that were clean energy. Used vehicles could still be bought and sold, but new production vehicles that were being manufactured in year 2030 or later could only be licensed in Washington State if they were clean energy.
So there's the plan.
Well, now,
what are the dealers going to do? They're all going to just start selling all electric cars in 2030 because that's all they can do, minus the used car sales?
They can sell whatever they want. They just can't. No one can register their car.
So fine. You don't register your car. So what's the deal? So we have to face a penalty for that?
That would be something worked out in the rules, I'm sure, down the line. It's nothing
whatever.
Specific in the bill.
You have to drive down to Oregon to get your license and drive back up.
Yeah.
Listen,
or
California and Hawaii are talking about the same kind of proposal. And the idea here is, again, we'd have the same things going on in the West Coast.
Idea, but here's the fundamental problem with electric cars, at least the ones we have now. It takes a half hour to charge it. So if you're going on a long trip, then you have to, I guess, schedule a long lunch halfway through because you can't just spend 5 minutes filling up and then be on your way.
And you can't just pull off the freeway and go to an electric charging station.
Well, that's what your plan does.
Supposedly, there would be as many charging stations.
That's good luck with that.
But my point is, even if there are as many charging stations as there are gas stations, there's going to be people parked there for a half hour.
I think the belief is that, and this is something that they would all look at, there's going to be advisory committees looking into all of what's happening in the market, the private market. And I think there's a presumption that that would be perhaps quicker by the time we go to that full transition in 2030. But it's certainly something they'll need to look at. Otherwise, you're going to have, the gas shortage lines.
Okay. This does not mandate, though, that they be electric, for example. If these were like hydrogen vehicles.
As long as they're 100% zero emission.
As long as they're zero emission, which hydrogen vehicles would be. But there's a lot of research that has to go into making that fueling process safe and affordable as well. I mean, it's a whole new infrastructure they got to build for that.
And absolutely. And so there's a lot of work. There are a couple of bills in Congress that talk about this same thing. Yeah. As she said, the UK just did this all throughout. Last week, they just passed this very similar legislation. So it's something that's being discussed. It's something that's being worked on. And it's something that the private market is moving towards. And that's why she was fairly optimistic about the bill, whether it's going to pass or not. This, she doesn't know yet. Maybe 50-50 chance. It does get a hearing, though, this afternoon.
What about RVs?
Every vehicle would have to be zero emission.
Good luck trying to get an electric RV to go anywhere. I mean, seriously, what are you going to do? Camp out and, hey, kids, we made it to Factoria. Great.
I saw no exemption for RVs.
Presumably it would have a much larger battery. But here's the other question. The whole idea is to reduce the carbon footprint, right? Is
mm-hmm.
that what I get from this?
Yes.
We're not worried about energy independence anymore because we already generate, get as much oil as we need. Has anybody examined the entire life cycle of electric vehicle technology, including the rare elements required to make the batteries and some of the problems disposing of and recycling them?
I'm sure someone has. I've not seen it in this build, so I don't know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, someone has to be looking at that to make sure we're not making something worse by changing this.
And the other thing is this would mean that even hybrid cars, like the ones I've been driving for years, would not be eligible for this because they use gasoline.
Right. Zero emissions. Yeah. No. Yeah. Yep. No, it would be zero emission vehicles. And look, what she's saying here is this, there's kind of been this feeling over the last couple of years that we've not done enough and there's more people kind of supporting this idea that we're not acting fast enough to deal with the climate change issue.
Yeah.
So we can't get any faster than now. That's what she told me.
I mean, there's the prospect that since there would be a guaranteed market for these zero emission cars, they would ramp up the research efforts and perfect this. I mean, ultimately, what you'd really want, of course, would be the nuclear-powered car because you would just fuel it once at the dealership and it would never need to be refueled again.
Zoom.
I would drive one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are you going to do? Just go everywhere with a diesel generator? I'm sure that's yeah. fine.
You seem to take this proposal quite personally.
Well, because my drivers out there are going, are you crazy? What if I work on a farm? What am I going to drive my truck? If I need a new truck and it's going to be a diesel, it's going to be an electric that can't pull or can't do with the job? I mean, come on.
All of these questions, and I was like, and you've read this bill with me.
Yeah,
there
I have.
Are
it's crazy.
Lines, there are advisory committees and people who are going to be looking into all of these questions that you're asking over the next 10 years. Is
yeah,
the
10
idea.
Years seems to be incredibly optimistic, considering the rate of production, the rate of ability to fuel your cars, to fuel them efficiently without mm-hmm. lines there, like, you know, you're waiting for bread and cheese in Russia back in the yeah. day. I mean, come on. I mean, I think that's way too optimistic.
You better
we can't
this,
even figure out the road usage charge in the next 10 years.
You take this message back to your friends in Olympia.
I
Chris
will.
Chris does not like this.
I will make
sure
they
I'm
sure
they'll
know.
Hear from the auto dealers this afternoon
yes,
at the hearing.
Yes, I'm sure. The hearing this afternoon should be quite interesting. We'll let you know what happens.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness Now, sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. And this morning, an update on a story we told you about just 1 week ago. CBS's Steve Hartman takes us back to the businessman who used his fortune to change the lives of hundreds of students and their parents.
As a soon-to-be graduating senior, tuition, room and board, books and fees will be paid for you, and you will go to college for free.
Safe to say, no school assembly has ever been more life-altering.
So too can one of your parents go to college or trade school for free.
It was a multi-generational game changer here at Scott High School in Toledo, Ohio. And all courtesy of a wealthy businessman named Pete Cadens, who will spend about $3 million sending these disadvantaged students to college.
I ask you only one favor in return.
But here's what really stuck with me.
Please don't ever use the word gift to describe what I did here today.
Why not? I wondered. Certainly, as our story went viral this week, that's the word many people use to describe his offer. What other word could you use?
Only use the word responsibility.
Over the years, I've done a lot of stories about wealthy people doing good deeds, but I've never heard of one with this catch. Don't say Pete gave you a gift. Say he fulfilled his responsibility. Because gift implies he had a choice, whereas responsibility implies obligation.
Pete Cadens also grew up in Toledo, but he attended a much wealthier school where college was expected. He worked hard and started three different companies. For that reason, Pete could easily claim to be a self-made man. But that's not how he framed it in his speech.
What became of my life was as much a factor of the inequities that exist in our society today as it was my skills, my talents, and my work ethic.
In other words, Pete says he didn't win at life fair and square. He says many successful people don't.
The competitive set, the people I compete with, were a lot smaller than it otherwise could be if everyone got the same level of education. And Martin Luther King always said, history has a long and sordid path of people and groups with privilege, protecting their privilege. Well, I'm done protecting my privilege.
Pete Cadens changed many lives that day. Now he's hoping to change mindsets, too.
And I hope others share in my responsibility in Toledo and around the world. Thank you.
Steve Hartman, on the road, in Toledo, Ohio.
Weekend following the Super Bowl is usually football-free, but not this year. In fact, over the weekend, the Seattle Dragons of the XFL scored the first-ever XFL touchdown.
Here's Seattle trailing by a field goal. Look at end zone. It is caught. Touchdown, Austin Kroll. On a dart from Silvers. And it's the first touchdown of this new XFL.
Unfortunately, they lost, but it was exciting enough that Chris watched all four XFL games.
Yep.
Right?
Watched portions of why. I didn't catch much of the Houston game after the Dragons. Watched a little bit, but I watched both games yesterday.
I watched the Dragons game. Did you watch any of it, G?
Absolutely.
It was awesome.
I went into it with low expectations, Dave Ross. It was amazing. It was amazing, and I have a bunch of reasons why. I'll kind of keep it short. First, the expectations for this were so low. the old saying of under promise and over deliver. That's exactly what the XFL did this weekend. So I'm watching and I'm like, all right. Like when you first take that bite of somebody's food, somebody's cooking, you're like, not bad. Yeah. All right. And then, so that was on Saturday. I'm like, yeah, you know, it was all right. But then Sunday, then you get to watching it. You're like, whoa, wait a minute. This is some good football. If you are a fan of football, then you're already hooked. You're watching. If you've watched it, you know. If you're not, you're like, yeah, gee, I really am not a little football fan. I don't really know anybody. That's the good part in this. Just like American Idol, right? When American Idol, these no-namers, they're up there trying, and you get to follow their path, right? And you get they might become stars. If they become stars, you can say that you watched them then. Well, with the XFL, you have the same opportunity. If these players, Dave, continue to play well, some of these guys will get to go to the NFL, and you can say, hey, I've been following that player since February. And so now they get their break.
Yeah.
This is amazing. It's here to stay. There's 8 teams now. I think it's going to grow in the future.
I hope so. My takeaways were I really enjoyed hearing the coaches calling the plays. I really enjoyed being back underneath that, kind of seeing behind the curtain a little bit, how they make their decisions, how calm they are as they're making their decisions, then hearing the quarterbacks doing their thing. I love hearing the replay guys take us through what they were doing, the pulling back of the curtain. I absolutely love that.
Now, if you don't know what we're talking about, they have the coaches are wearing headsets, and they broadcast it, and the players also hear everything. And this is the last play of the game. Jim Zorn calls it.
Keenan, you got to come off. Keenan, Alonzo, go to Z. Zoe, go to Z. All right, here we go. Double right open. 31 ace. Y shallow. Dagger. And you got a B check. You got a B check, 23. Y shallow. Dagger. Here we go.
That means you have a 757 coming in for final approach at Payne Field. And they take a left turn on runway 45.
No, that doesn't know.
Now, the one thing that kept being funny to me, guys, it was really funny, is they're calling the plays and they're covering their mouths. I'm like,
yeah, I know. What
hey, part? we can hear you.
Now, does the opposing coach hear this? That's what we don't know.
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think that you should. Look, because this game is, I believe, is a good product, they're going to have to stop that soon. There's no way. They're not going to be able to continue that.
I don't know. That's one of the big draws. See, I get to go to the game this weekend at the Dragons opener. Because yeah. But the thing is, we're not going to get that behind the headset feel during the game, so I'll just have to go back to normal and enjoy the good football. But I just liked that. Also, the interviewing of players in between. Yes. I love the best one. Guy throws an interception. Yeah, what'd you see on that play? I missed a safety. You just missed a kick. I missed a kick. It's like, are you kidding me? It's like the last thing you want to do as a reporter on the sideline when you blow a kick.
That's the part that's dicey. Here's one of the interviews where the guy got called for a personal foul.
Dylan, I know you're involved in there. What happened?
I don't know. There's just a lot of chatter after a play. We're trying to make some stuff happen, and they're doing a little extra pushing and shoving. We're trying to get our f***ing job done.
That was the Seattle Dragon.
Now, and they yanked the plug right after the swear word had already gone out over the air.
What I love about that is this, is now we, the fans, get to see just how simplistic football really can be. It's not as technical. So after you would have interviewed him after the game, after he's had his shower and everything, well, what happened on that play? Well, you know, in this case, he'd give you some kind of technical answer.
Yeah.
But in this case, now you get to like, you know, we just got our, but you know what kicked in, you know, that kind of deal. Another thing that stood out to me is some of the changes that I believe the NFL are going to look at and adopt.
Yeah.
Here's one. When you kick the ball off, Dave, and it's for a kick return, instead of the running starts that the teams get, you have to wait for the kick returner to catch it, and then you engage. That is so much safer for the game, considering CTE is a big deal.
Yeah.
I think at some point the NFL will adopt that.
And they're only 5 yards apart, too, down at like the 35-yard line.
That.
So it becomes like a basketball one-on-one
yes.
kind of blocking deal.
And also the no kick for the extra point. You can go for one,
three,
two, or three. And even Jim Zorn said that that kind of brings a different strategy to the game. The XFL is great. I'm glad the Dragons kick off here at CenturyLink Field this week. Oh,
gets
man.
The Vipers.
Yeah.
Tampa
and
Bay.
Winning team gets $100,000 to split. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
So you have some real motivation there.
So, Dave, you liked it?
Yeah, I did.
Did you like it? Okay, good.
Yeah. It was similar enough to the NFL that I understood everything,
mm-hmm.
but different enough that I couldn't stop watching.
Best line of the weekend, last night the game,
yeah.
There was a bad snap to the quarterback wasn't ready. He had to run back and get the ball. And he was like, and the quarterback eludes the cameraman. Like, that's something you won't get in the NFL because there's no cameraman sitting behind the quarterback.
G. Scott with G. and Ursula starts at 9. Thank you, G. It has been 10 years and 2 months since Susan Powell disappeared. Of course, her husband was suspected, husband Josh suspected in that. It was, 8 years ago that...
just a little over 8 years, yeah.
The couple's young sons were murdered by Josh. And now the lawsuit is underway. The lawsuit against the state over the death of the boys, which is heading to Pierce County Court today. And Hannah Scott is here with the latest on that.
So, Dave, this is one of the final chapters in the saga surrounding Puyallup native Susan Cox Powell, who, of course, vanished in Utah back in 2009. Her husband, Josh, long considered a person of interest, eventually a suspect in her disappearance. Josh Powell had moved back to Washington with the couple's young sons, Charlie and Braden, shortly after Susan disappeared. They moved in with his dad, Stephen Powell, who eventually went to prison on voyeurism and child pornography charges. During the time that the boys lived with Josh and his dad, Susan's parents, Chuck and Judy Cox, fought to get those boys out of the home. They always believed that Josh had killed their daughter and that the boys' lives were at risk. The state eventually took custody of the boys, and they were sent to live with Susan's parents. But Josh was allowed visitation, and it was during one of those visits that Josh killed himself and his boys when he set his home on fire in Graham in 2012. Susan's parents sued the state over their deaths. Ann Bremner is the family lawyer and says the suit basically claims DHS's negligence led to the boys' deaths.
We were claiming that they had red flags throughout the time that they had the kids in their care, custody, and control that they either willfully ignored or failed to act on. And they're required, if there's issues with respect to the children's safety, to make sure the children are safe.
Among the red flags that were missed?
The fact that they were living in Stephen Powell's home, that the police called that a house of horrors, that there was a noose hanging from the ceiling, that there were gallows. There was a picture of a woman that had was looking sexually violated on the wall. There was pornography on 15 computers, child pornography from Stephen Powell's. That was one of the red flags. That's where the children lived. DSHS or CPS should have been concerned for their safety from that.
But the court documents claim there are many other red flags that were missed, as well as several direct requests for DSHS to investigate the boys and the circumstances of their living situation to see if they were safe that essentially went unanswered, were never followed up on, including some that came directly from law enforcement. The biggest red flag, of course, though, that they point to is that Josh Powell was a suspect in his wife's disappearance. Visitation, also a big issue in this case. The visitation that was allowed to Josh Powell was supposed to be in a DSHS-secured facility. There was a change at the last minute to allow him to have that visit in his home. That was the first visit in his home when those boys were killed. And the social worker came to the door, knocked on the door with the boys. Josh grabbed the boys and shut the door in that social worker's face and then attacked them in the most brutal manner and then set the home on fire. They were both still alive after being attacked with a hatchet by their dad and then died in those flames. So all of that, they say, could have been avoided if DSHS hadn't been negligent starting way back when all the years that went on while there were the stuff going on with Susan Powell's parents trying to get the boys hadn't happened. So that's essentially what the case is. For the Chuck and Judy Cox, Susan's parents, Ann Bremner says that this is everything for them, this case.
Well, it's it means everything. You know, for them to see justice, potentially in the case of the loss of these beautiful boys, their grandchildren, and they hope that through this vehicle, through the courts, that there will be changes with the way that children are treated in this state when they're in the custody of the agency, that this never happened again.
And that's really what they've been pushing for since they filed this case, which was back in 2013. It's taken mm-hmm. this many years to work its way through to finally get jury selection beginning today. They want to make sure there's some changes.
First, that the facts are aired and people understand what happened and what went wrong. you know, as we've alleged. But second, what's going to happen from here? And will their deaths mean something? Will they mean something that will impact future lives in a positive way? And that would be the legacy that our clients would most want for their grandchildren. And, of course, Susan.
The state, I should point out, in their trial court briefings say, you know what, the liability here lies with Josh Powell, even though he's dead. Yeah. It's his fault that these kids died. It's not the state's.
Yeah, as I recall, we had a policy, I don't know how far back it goes, is that you err on the side of keeping the family together, right?
That's always, yes. But in this case, there's multiple areas where they point out, again, going back to when Josh Powell and the boys lived in the home with Josh's dad, and there are details in these court documents that we've not heard before about the things they found in that home.
Worse than what we've heard?
Yes, absolutely. Things that I couldn't say on our morning show about things that they...
And DSH just knew about this. What's their comeback then? My recollection, I admit it's kind of foggy, is that it was because of this policy that even in the face of some of these horrible things, you tried to repair the family. Now, the fact that we haven't anything even approaching this come up in the news since then, as far as I know, indicates that they must have changed something. I mean, because the argument is that if you go into a home and you see a noose, and if you see some of this other, I guess, unspeakable stuff, regardless of what the policy says, you get the kids out of there and then, you know, deal with the legality of that later, which they failed to do in this case.
Right. And eventually they did get the kids out of there and they took them into custody. And then they were allowed to live with Susan's parents. But yeah, you know, always in the basic beginnings of these types of cases, you want to allow the parent to try to keep the family together. But in this case, I mean, he's a suspect in his wife's disappearance. There's so much going on with that his Susan's parents consistently warned that those boys were in danger. And that's what they're saying. But really, one of the things is that when a state is caring for foster children, there's always been this it's absolute immunity or something where they can't really be held liable for things that happen to the kids when they're in the state's care. But there was a court case about a year ago. The Ninth Circuit heard a case and came out and said that there is room for the negligence claim against anyone, against any state when it comes to foster children. Yeah. So
I'm wondering if with our new involuntary commitment laws or red flag laws, would a guy like Josh have popped up on the radar? Could he have been? I mean, the guy was clearly crazy, right? I mean, wasn't there a way? I know it's an unkind word, but I think it applies in this case. Couldn't he have been committed somehow?
I don't know if anything, the way that it all trickled out and that the information came to light, I don't know that there would have been anything that could have gotten him committed in court in time to save Susan or to save the boys. Yeah. I don't know, but possibly. There's so much. He and his certain members of his family and his father especially, who's now dead, really circled the wagons, and they were very good at what they did. They had a lot of people duped, and things didn't come out. I mean, some of the things that were ignored, some of the things that the boys said that indicated there was some really bizarre things happening in the home that were not really investigated and overlooked, some of the details that have come out here, I just don't think those details came to light in time.
And so there is... Nobody's gotten any closer to finding out what happened to Susan.
No, she was officially, legally declared dead in November, this last November. Mm-hmm. You know, no one believes that they'll find her alive for sure, and it's very doubtful that they'll find her remains ever. So this, you know, Susan's parents, Chuck and Judy Cox, have gone on and started a charity in these boys' names, Charlie and Brayden Powell. It's focused on helping kids who have been victims of violence and their families. And they've done everything they can to be strong and positive and move forward from this. This would be the one thing that I know from being with them throughout this process would be so important to them, to just feel like their boys' deaths meant something.
Right. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Now we take you to one of the waterfront jewels of Snohomish County, the city of Edmonds. After 44 votes, the city council finally filled an open seat by electing Luke Distelhorst, who joins us now. And that was the amazing thing about this story, 44 votes. This is one of those things where you're filling a vacancy left by one of the council members who left to become mayor, and it is up to the remaining council members to choose from a group of people who applied. So you decided to basically put in your application for the job?
Yeah, correct. They announced it and had it open for a little bit over a week and had 12 applicants for the position.
And so what made you want to do this?
You know, we moved to Edmonds about 6 years ago and started volunteering in the community and just became really involved. And when the seat opened up, I thought it would be a great opportunity to kind of continue that service and contribute to our little city.
And what do you do for a living?
I do communications at Community Transit.
Okay. So you weren't even one of the first candidates they considered, right? With the first set of ballots, I believe your name didn't even come up?
Correct. I was not nominated until round five.
What do you do in a case? Do you lobby behind the scenes? Do you buy ads in the local newspaper? I mean, what was the process? How did you get your name on the ballot then?
So this actually all happens in one evening at one council meeting and all in front of the public. So they open up the nominations and council members can nominate who they would like to see appointed, and it goes through voting. And if they reach a deadlock, which is considered three ballots in a row with the exact same makeup of votes, then they open it up to a second round of nominations. So during this whole process, I was in the audience at the city council chambers with my wife and our 13-year-old daughter watching it unfold.
Uh-huh. And so you didn't stand up and say, pick me, pick me? You just waited until the finger of fate pointed in your direction?
Yeah, I sat in the back row and anxiously waited. I was nominated in round five, which was ballot 35.
So while those votes are taking place, between those ballots, do they invite the various candidates to speak, or do you just sit there silent?
Yeah, you pretty much wait in the audience as an observer. As part of the process, everyone filled out an application and then went through a formal interview with all of council, and also certain council members met privately with candidates or applicants one-on-one.
The original choices were then removed. You go on the ballot. So you're sort of like the Mike Bloomberg of Edmonds, suddenly riding in at the last minute to become the compromise choice?
Yeah, I don't know about that comparison, but people are still able to be nominated even in those later rounds. So people who are nominated in round one were still nominated alongside myself in round five.
All right, so you're on the council. What's your agenda going to be? What's the focus of your campaign here?
As we've seen throughout the Puget Sound region, we're going to be experiencing a lot of growth and a lot of change in our communities. I grew up in the Green Lake neighborhood of Seattle, ended up moving overseas and then coming to Canada and then settling in Edmonds. And over that time, we've obviously seen a lot of change, and I think that's going to continue to happen. So what I'm looking forward to hoping that I can contribute to is sort of working with that growth and change and ensuring that we do it in a responsible way in our community and that we have options for people to stay in our community and to thrive in our community. Mm-hmm.
So your bumper sticker would say, Luke Distelhorst, responsible growth.
Maybe.
I also noticed that you are the only male member of the Edmonds City Council?
Yes.
So what's that going to be like?
I think it will be really productive. You know, I think there are six council members on there, including three of them who are new, who are really dedicated to the city and who want to work toward tangible results. So I'm really looking forward to working with them.
Well, you've said all the right things, Luke. So congratulations. I can see that you're an accomplished politician already, and I wish you luck.
Thank you so much.
Luke Distelhorst, Edmonds City Council member. And I thought that the 44 votes that it took to get him in set some kind of a record. Actually, no, the Democrats had him beat long ago. In the 1924 Democratic Convention, they chose John W. Davis on the 103rd ballot to go up against Herbert Hoover. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.